You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Ryan, hi.
Hi.
How are you? That was very Yiddish of you. How are you? I hope you guys had a glorious weekend. Our music video came out. Sunspin. I directed my first music video, a little low budget music video called Summertime Neighbor, one of the tracks on the new album, which you can get on iTunes and Amazon on your computer, not your phone. Just go on your computer and download it. This is a CD. See that? But anyway, Summertime Neighbor, the music video came out and people are digging it. I'm glad. It was a fun half a day, maybe three fourths of a day work. And it was nice to be out there and, you know, just kind of guiding the ship and enjoying it. So that was fun. What else? I watched this documentary on Billie Holiday and, it was a little heavy.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, she died at 44 years old, young man. And she, what a voice. And she just went through a lot in her life. And, you know, remember, I don't know if I'm quoting her exactly, but she was talking about death and she said, I think we're all trying to put 100 days into one. Huh. And it was something like that, which really rang true for me, because I think we're trying to do, instead of just living here right now in the moment, enjoying it, we're doing 100 things. We're ahead of ourselves. We're not really enjoying this moment. Like, I'm not really enjoying my time with you right now because...
Me neither.
I'm kidding.
What a fucking drag.
What a drag, man. This fucking sucks. But, you know, it was kind of interesting. It was like she said something like, we're trying to fit 100 days into one. And it's just like, just relax, you know. And I could be misquoting her, but it was something along those lines. And it just resonated with me. And I think that's the thing. We're always thinking ahead so much. We're always thinking about what we could do and how we could do. And sometimes, man, I don't know how many times you hear about when people are on their deathbed, they ask them and they're just like, I wish I just would have been more present. I wish I would have just not worked so much. I wish I would have. Mm-hmm. And if you're hearing it from so many people, I mean, this isn't just like one or two people, but they've done studies. Then why don't we just, everybody just stop fucking working. Everybody just stop what you're doing right now. Go hug something. I don't know.
Well, we can't do that now.
Right. No, don't hug anybody. That's not what I meant. It was proverbial hug.
you mean what you said, hug something. Just
hug an object. Hug your dog.
Hug a tree.
Hug a door.
Hug a door.
Hug a...
It's all a goddamn
miracle. I don't know why I want to say hug a dick.
No, that's on a person and that could have COVID on it.
COVID could, it could have COVID dick. I don't, sorry for getting crass this early in the morning. I normally don't, you know that, so forgive me. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Last week was a lot of fun. Last week was Zach Levi.
Mm-hmm.
And did very well, and I appreciate everybody listening. And he really opened up more than he usually does, and he opens up a lot normally. So thank you, Zach Levi. Please go listen to it if you haven't. The Michael Cudlitz from Walking Dead's great. Katie Cassidy from Arrow. Hers is really touching, and she talks about her dad, David Cassidy. And so it's important that you guys write a review. And if you're enjoying the podcast, it truly helps the podcast. So Ryan, just give them those.
At Inside of You Pod on Twitter, at Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah. So just follow us, and on Apple Podcast or wherever, please write a review and tell me you're digging the show. And that bumps us up in the ratings, if that means anything to some people, which it might mean something to my boss over at Westwood One. They might say, oh, look, you jumped to 98.
Oh, isn't that special?
Isn't that special? If you want to get any cool merch like signed CDs of the band, go to sunspin.com. We've got hats, lunch boxes. And if you want anything related to, you know, Smallville, Lex Luthor, all that stuff. We got Lex Luthor t-shirts, Smallville lunchboxes. That's on the Inside of You online store. So you can get that. I think there's a discount code going on right now. There's a Sunspin code right now. The Sunspin code on the sunspin.com for merch is Sunspin 10.
I don't know this.
Shit, I don't even know. Try it. Try it. See if that shit works. I want to say thanks to Ryan for working so hard, and Bryce for giving us a good podcast here. You guys are really, you know, you put it together, and it's nice to, I don't know, it's nice to do something that you're proud of, and it's quality. I think we're giving people quality. The sound, you know, it sounds good. It looks good on the YouTube when you edit it.
The equipment's great.
The equipment's great. We have a nice room here. You know, you could write into us at hello@insideofyoupodcast.com. thanks to all my patrons out there who support the podcast. If you want to join Patreon, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful family. I'll text you right after you join. It's Patreon, patreon.com/insideofyou or inside. Patreon.com/insideofyou. Try inside of you or inside. Anyway, I think that's it. Why don't we get into our guest? You know, this guest is, you know him from MTV and Jackass and like all these movies, but he's really started his own little empire. I got to give it to him. I mean, this guy's been through some hell and he keeps fighting and keeps coming through. And, you know, he talks, he's pretty open about, you know, we talked about, I believe, unless you cut it, Ryan, about loving thyself and, you know, you like yourself. These questions seem kind of trivial and like, well, what does it really mean? I hate when people ask me that. It's a legit question. I mean, Ryan, if I said, do you like yourself? You're probably going to say,
I'm okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
You love yourself?
I do.
Okay. To see, that's a pretty quick, solid answer. I honestly can't answer those questions as easily, but I'm working on that. So when I ask people sometimes, and I don't do it to interrogate, but I think sometimes, you know, I think that answer is deep inside you. And It's like, it takes, I don't know what the fuck I'm saying. It takes time to really be honest with yourself. Cause you could say, yeah, I fucking love myself, man. I'm awesome. Oh, I'm fucking great. But I think it stems from childhood. I really do think there's a certain thing where, you know, something happens along the way and I'm not blaming, but you know, then you're like, fuck, why don't I love myself? That's weird. I think I'm a good guy for the most part, but nah, I'm irritable. I could be a little bitch. You know, and then you start doubting yourself, and that's what, so you got to really stop that, stop being so hard on yourself. So that's what I'm learning, that, hey, you know, we all fuck up every day. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. You make mistakes. You dump your boyfriend or your girlfriend. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. If you cheat on them, does it mean you're bad? No, it probably means that you did a bad thing and you're bad in that moment, but does that mean you're bad for the rest of your life? You're terrible. I'm not insinuating that I'm cheating. I have a girlfriend to cheat on for that matter. I'm just saying in general. Let's get into Steve-O.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
What's up, dude?
I'm just kicking it, man.
What a great bed. Are you in an RV, man?
I sure am. This is my traveling podcast studio, tattoo shop, movie trailer, surf mobile.
You have a tattoo shop in your trailer?
Yeah, it's a Class B motorhome built on a Dodge Ram chassis.
Oh.
It's a little bit smaller than your average tattoo shop, but we get it done.
Do you know how to tattoo people, or you have someone who tattoos?
No, I do, man. I'm actually an apprentice at this time. But it seems that tattoos from Steve-O are in rather high demand.
are they quality?
They are surprisingly good for a tattoo from Steve-O. I've got a tattoo portfolio that I'm just so serious about, man. You know, I really put effort into it, and it came about. I never thought about it. You know, like the first tattoo I ever did was, I think, 2006. And someone just produced a tattoo machine while I was on stage performing in front of a crowd. I wanted to be quick about it. I never wiped away the ink. I was just tattooing in this big mess of black ink. And then I was tattooing my name. When I finished and wiped away the ink, I had misspelled my own name. It said Stevo. And it was just an awful experience overall. And and over the years, you know, when presented with a tattoo machine, I'd be like, yeah, sure. But then a year and a half ago, I decided, what if I really tried? What if I took on, you know, somewhat ambitious designs and did my absolute best? And I was surprised by the results. So now I got a whole apprenticeship. I believe I've just sold a television show called Steve-O's Bad News Tattoos.
You believe you sold the show? You're not sure yet?
Well, we've sold the it's not a pilot. I think they don't make pilots anymore as much because when the pilot's shot, they can't really air it because it sticks out like a sore thumb as not part of the series.
Right.
So they sort of scale it back. And I understand that we've been granted $75,000 to make a proper presentation of what the show would look like.
Right. Now, I think about things like art, and that's one thing I run from. Like, I'm not a good artist. I can barely make a 3D L, or you know how you make it look 3D. Like, I couldn't even imagine that. So were you like, were you always drawing cool shit and designs?
I think it's a misconception that tattooing is a function of drawing. It's really much more a function of tracing. You know, you'll trace on the carbon paper for what's called the stencil, and then you'll trace over that with the needle. I mean, sure, when you get into shading and stuff, there's a level of art to it, but you don't have to actually draw the thing, you trace it.
But I'm colorblind too.
Good. Maybe it's not for you. And it's a lot of work, man. There's no question about it. But there's a level of satisfaction that comes with being surprised by the fact that you did a better job than you thought you could.
Well, kudos, man. Well, kudos. You know, I look at your life and all this shit, and everybody knows you, and you're world famous. You got you have 5 million people on YouTube watching your channel, and you do these kind of sit down, talk about your life and moments and intercut videos. And it's really cool. I just watched the surfing one about how you had his wrong name and everybody was fucking up the dude's name that surfed this giant wave.
But you
posted it. And unfortunately you were called the asshole. 22 million people, I guess, tweeted the wrong person. You fucked his name up. So they gave.
Well, right. Yeah. I saw a clip that a buddy of mine had posted. It was this guy surfing like an 80-foot wave. And they're saying it was the biggest wave ever ridden. And I thought, right on, you know, and I posted it too, giving credit to what turned out to be the wrong surfer. And, you know, a bunch of people had posted this clip crediting the wrong surfer, but I was the guy whose post got 22 million views.
Jesus.
So that was the headline. Steve-O posts big wave surf, you know, wrong surfer. Wrong guy.
What's your dog's name there?
This is Wendy.
Wendy.
I found her in the streets of Peru. You really look like a hoe, Wendy.
Your legs propped up there.
Get your act together. Yeah, this dog is a bit of a celebrity in her own right. I found her in the streets of Peru. And this is bittersweet, but the video that I made and posted of finding this dog in the streets of Peru is the most viewed piece of content that I've ever posted online. It got over 100 million views, the video of me finding this dog. And as wonderful as it is, it's heartwarming, and this dog is my companion. But for fuck's sake, the lengths I've gone to try to get attention. And it's the finding the dog video that was a hit.
Unfortunately, it was the wrong dog.
Yeah, it stings that was the most attention I ever got. But what can you do?
Well, I think that's kind of cool. Think about it, man. It's like something. It's like affectionate. It's empathetic. Yeah. It's like what people really like. So it's like a side of you maybe that they weren't used to or accustomed to.
True. I'll give you that. So,
yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I've been walked through entire days with this dog, and every single person that stopped for a photo knew her by name. It's crazy, man.
That's all. You know, I look at all this shit, man, and you know, I look at your life and I'm like, here's a guy, your dad was corporate, right? He was kind of a corporate guy. And you go to clown school. You went to Barnum and Bailey for like circus school, which, I mean, were you doing shit at a young age? Your dad's in a suit and tie and you're like jumping off cliffs and, you know.
I mean, a little bit. Sure. I mean, I heard a story about me as a toddler, you know, not even walking, I don't think. And they said that I was like climbing out of a window on some like 15th story, you know, apartment or something. Yeah, I was definitely acting like an asshole from a very early age. And my overdeveloped need for attention was prominent, you know, out of the gate. So I've always been an attention whore. And, you know, at whatever age, there was always just something that that I was acting out with.
Did you feel like it was because, you know, with me, I can relate. I always wanted to make my father laugh. I always wanted him to like accept me. I always wanted, and my dad was very corporate work, you know, 6 to 5 or 6 every night. And, you know, I think I was sort of like my mom in a way where I was kind of all over the place, short attention span, didn't know what the hell I was doing, wasn't good in school, started, you know, acting and things like that. And just, I think he just kind of looked at me like, eh, fuck this son. I guess the next son's going to be better. And, you know, my other brother was smarter and they got along better. In fact, my mom once was, I remember saying, oh, Mark, to my dad, I know Eric's your favorite. We all know Eric's your favorite in front of me. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. I mean, I knew it, but to hear my mother say it. So what I'm saying is I always was like, it wasn't enough. And I felt like I was always trying to get attention from other people, from whatever, because I didn't get that attention with my dad. Do you think that there was part of that?
Is Eric an older brother?
Eric is my younger brother. He's the smarter one. Yeah, he's like 6 years younger.
So I think that, to me, is an indication that neither of your parents are alcoholic. Is that right?
That's actually, you know, my mom was sort of a pill popper a little bit. My dad really never drank, but he was extremely strict, you know, even though he did a bunch of shit, which I didn't know. I mean, if you, like, you would have been in prison. Like, my dad, if it was you, because he... I remember I got my ear pierced by the next door neighbor and I looked at him with my opposite ear and I go, hey, what would you think if I ever got my ear pierced? He goes, you'd go to a halfway house is what you do. I go, oh, see, well, I'm going to be at Nate's next door for the next week till this heals. You know what I mean? So like, sure. So was your father like that? Was he strict? Did you feel like you needed to act out or?
Well, yeah. I mean, my whole family dynamic is it really explains everything. Take it, you know, the sort of one piece at a time. Yes, my dad was strict and he was a corporate executive, but his job involved a great deal of travel. So he was almost not there more than he was there. And so it was a very inconsistent, like if dad was around, he would try to kind of compensate for the time he was gone by being more of a disciplinarian, I think, you know? And so it was just like, dad's not here. I can do whatever. Dad's here. Oh, you know, it's sort of an inconsistent thing. And as far as the family dynamic goes, my dad was actually sort of the black sheep of his family for choosing a career in business. He came from just a long line of academics, scholars, theologians, clergymen, zoologists, you know, like he was, it was just very, very like incredibly academic and low earning lineage that my dad came from. You know, he grew up with very little money, but just a lot of prestige, you know, all this scholastic kind of a thing. And then, you know, his dad was a published author and a zoologist and a decorated, you know, army colonel, all this very, very respected family. And then dad's going to go into business. And that was like, all right, well, that's not what I would have chosen for you, son, you know? And then on my mom's side of the family, it's all alcoholism, you know, gambling, suicide, like addiction, like just really, really dark, you know, addiction stuff. And the way that that works, I have an older sister. I'm the second of two children. And it's sort of a cookie cutter kind of a deal that when you have an absentee alcoholic parent, that the first child will really overachieve, you know, it's like, wow, I'm not being noticed, you know, like I've got, like my parents have other stuff going on. They're not paying attention to me. So to try to get noticed, I'm going to overachieve. I'm going to get straight A's. I'm going to look at me. I'm perfect. You know, is that enough for you? And I think that's a pretty regular sort of stereotype that really applies to my situation, where I have this overachieving older sister, and then I come into the picture. You know, there's not a lot of attention being doled out by either parents because dad's gone and mom's drunk, and my sister is this perfect straight A character doing everything right. And you know, the second child comes along and looks at the efforts of the older child and says, wow, there is no fucking way I can compete with that. Right. You know, like I'm not even going to try to compete with the straight A's and do everything. So I'm just going to try to get through, like, you know, based on, you know, just being a class clown, kind of like go for laughs, you know, like that, you know, and not even try to achieve anything. But at the end of the day, what my dad's family brings to the table is this like intense drive for whatever it's for. And so like I'm a hybrid of my dad's side's sort of tenacity and perseverance, coupled with my mom's side's deviance, you know, deviance and dysfunction. And so I'm like just this hyper perseverant fucking, you know, like deviant with a really overdeveloped need for attention. And I think that when you look at it that way, it makes sense how it turned out the way it did.
Yeah, I read something where it was like, it was years later, because you know your mom was sick, she had an aneurysm or something, and your dad was, you guys were talking outside, and this was like 2003.
That was actually in 1998. My mom died in 2003. And she died after having survived a brain aneurysm 5 years prior. And it was just sort of like one of these things where, you know, I understood that she like cooked some three course meal, you know, like normal. And then like the next morning, like kind of got up and whatever happened, like she had just had a blood vessel in her brain just pop, and there was no way to see it coming or anything. And it was just a super, you know, get her to the hot, you know, and most people don't survive these subarachnoid brain hemorrhages. And mom did survive it, but was left really physically and mentally disabled. And in the, you know, she had brain surgery, all this, and the family came from, all dad, I think, had flew over from England, and my sister and I were in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We all met in Florida, and it was just this kind of crisis management situation. And we left at the hospital just for a meal. And it was at this restaurant, and you know, this crazy circumstances where mom's, you know, got this brain thing. And dad chose that time to say, hey, son, I feel I've done a disservice to you by not supporting you in this career path that you've clearly committed yourself to. And he said, you know, my dad, I didn't choose what my dad wanted. And he had a similar conversation with him, you know, son, you're not doing what I would have chosen for you, but given that you're committed to it, I just want you to be the best at it. You know, I pledge to support you. And it put a lot of wind in my sails.
Were you emotional?
It was a heavy, heavy situation. I mean, that was like the least of what was going on at the time. Yeah, I mean, it meant a lot, you know. It was almost like, all right, you know, I almost didn't think that would really change a whole lot. I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm kind of a loser. At that point, I had not made any money. I had not really accomplished anything. I'd had, photos in a couple of skateboard magazines, and the photos were not of me skateboarding. You know, like I just did not have my act together. And So it's a big credit to my dad that he, you know, didn't jump on the bandwagon after I had some success. You know, like I really love to say that I don't feel that having a great relationship with my father is because I'm successful, but rather I think that, you know, I've been able to achieve some success because I have a great relationship with my father. And that's a really major distinction that does make me feel emotional. My dad's support's been a big deal.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, I love BetterHelp. They've been around here a long time. And I am convinced that therapy is such an important part of our lives. The stigma, I think, is going away, and more people are veering towards therapy and helping themselves because it's all about the future. You know, if you can work on yourself now, you're going to be a better, stronger person later. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, folks, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. Therapy with BetterHelp is just a good place to start when you want to understand you better. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. And all you do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/inside today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/inside.
Inside of You is brought to you by Shopify. If you haven't used Shopify and you're starting your own business, I don't know who you are. I don't even want to talk to you because Shopify is so easy to use. It is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. And it's so easy to manage and navigate. For instance, on Talkville and Inside of You, I do it all. I see what the best product selling is. I see what's the least product selling is. I can easily check how much money I've made for the month. It's easy to add a product. It's all so simple. I can do it. It's right there for you. It's just so easy to use. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere.
From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms.
And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at Shopify.com/inside, all lowercase. Go to Shopify.com/inside now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/inside. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify.
That's profound, man. Because, yeah, I mean, like, I've never really heard that. I think there's certain... people are built a certain way. Like, you're built a certain way. You're an entertainer. You like to do crazy things and you just go with your gut and you explore. And then there are some people who are like, this is what I know. And they don't understand that other side, that side of you or whatever. And to appreciate it, to respect it, to be able to look at someone and go, hey, he's not like me. You know, I don't think I've had that. Like, you know, I think my dad does the best he can with me. With the way he feels, like, right. it's just like, hey, the nurses need some pictures at the hospital for your sister, you know? And I'm like, okay, I'll sign them. It's not, hey, I just want you to know if you suck, if you fail, I love you. That doesn't exist. That's never existed in my life. I've never heard it. So I was kind of curious. And I didn't know that, like, he approached you like this before you had the success. So again, when you said that's a profound, what did that do for you? Did that kind of open?
Sorry, I jumped in because I'm so excited to answer the question. it put fucking wind in my sails, man. Like that, the year was 1998. And I think that, you know, at the time there were, the video camera was really not like a household item. You know, not even like every household didn't have a video camera, let alone everybody having a video camera in their pocket. You know, there was about enough home video cameras to sustain America's Funniest Home Videos. And at that time, I think that the, you know, at that time, there was another show that had come up called Real TV. And Real TV was, you know, while America's Funniest Home Videos was family friendly and kind of really funny and like, you know, this light and fun, like Real TV was more like gnarly stuff caught on tape, you know, like it was a little bit darker, a little bit, you know. And it was after that conversation with my dad that I saw a commercial on TV for Real TV. And it was this pitch, you know, it says, hey, if you have,
uh-oh, hang on a second, I lost you. That's all right.
Yeah, I had another call come in.
That's all right.
So I saw this commercial and it said, if you have a video that you think we should see, then send it on in to Real TV. And I was like, oh, well, fuck, you know, like I had tons of video. So I had all these videos that I sent them in, you know, and it was like, I called the numbers. I said, I don't have footage that you might want to see. I have footage that you need badly. You know, I'm just going to put it like that. Like I'm sitting on some gold. And so they got back to me and they gave me the information to mail it in. Cause you know, watching footage on the internet wasn't even a thing. I sent in the footage and they got back to me and they said, we really like the clip of you on top of the 3-story building, setting yourself on fire and doing the fire breathing flip off the roof into the pool. And I was like, is that all out of everything I fucking sent you? That's all that you guys want? And they were like, yeah, we just want that clip. We want you jumping without the fire. Then we want to show you jumping with the fire. And they said, we want to give you $500 for exclusive rights to these clips. And I was like, well, what does that mean? I'd never heard of such a thing. And they were like, well, then that means that we own it. And, you know, we own it exclusively. We're the only owners of it. So I'm like, so I came and like show people that like basically no, you know, I'm like, fuck, you know, I want to be on TV. You know, I'd never been on TV, but like, I don't want to give away my rights. And so in a panic, I called up my dad, like dad, they're exclusive. You know, and my dad, trademark dad, he said, son, or whatever. He said, look, Steve, like calm down, take a breath. Okay. This is really simple. He says, you got to just figure out at which point it's a deal breaker for you. You draw a line in the sand and you just stick to it. He says, it sounds to me like it's a deal breaker, this exclusivity clause. So why don't you call them back and say, I'm not okay with giving away exclusive rights. You can have non-exclusive rights and you got to give me $1,000 for that. And that's what I did. and they had no problem with it. Okay, cool. Non-exclusive, you get $1,000. And that was like my first deal, you know,
first step in negotiation.
This is my first, and it's more negotiating than I ever did for Jackass. You know,
yeah.
I don't know how, like, given that I had this, you know, high power business father in my corner, you know, it seems to follow that I should have done much better with all the Jackass deals over the years. But I suppose I'm also glad that I didn't,
die
too hard on that. didn't die and didn't push too hard to where like it would have soured the relationship, you know, because everything worked out well in the end.
Right. So from there, it's sort of like, you know, that video where when you saw it on TV, you're like, oh, fuck. Was it just like that feeling of like, look at this?
It was much more anticlimactic because I thought that being on TV was going to really change something or other, you know, like, and it was just, that fucking thing came and went. Not one person ever mentioned that they saw it. There was, you know, there's a very different experience having that one clip come out on Real TV compared to when I had my first like real bit on Jackass, which was the swallowing the goldfish and barfing it up into a fishbowl. Right. That one, I had one thing on the first episode of Jackass, but you could barely recognize me, and it wasn't like a really notable bit. It was the second episode of Jackass where I had the goldfish trick, and I did, dude. There was an audience for Jackass right away, and like the next day, like 24 hours, like within 24 hours of that goldfish bit playing for the first time, I noticed that my life was different. You know, I heard about it like all over the place, and it was crazy. And I think that when it was maybe 1 week after that, I got a call from the executive producer guy, and he said, all right, here's the deal. The show's a hit, you know. Now, like, we had done 8 episodes for the first season. You know, for the entire first season, I was paid less than $1,500 after taxes, as I recall.
Each episode.
No, I got paid per bit. I didn't get paid per episode. I got paid per bit. It was $500 for a bit if it was like dangerous and risky. And if it was just like a little gag or you know, a prank that wasn't like high impact, then it was $200.
So it's like a stuntman, literally like a stuntman. The more dangerous it is, the more money you make, but they're not paying you that much money.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Like a medical study when I had the government test drugs on me. The more dangerous the study, the more money you get.
Right.
But yeah, so I got paid per bit, and all of the bits put together, you know, it was like $1,500 about after taxes. And so I got this call like 3 episodes in. And they said, all right, the show's a hit. It's the highest ratings that MTV's ever had for like a half hour format kind of a thing. And so we know we got to pay you. And MTV's ordering 16 episodes, you know, like there's 8 episodes per season. They're ordering seasons 2 and 3 in one go, 16 episodes. And we know we got to pay you. So we're going to give you $2,000 per episode. And I remember thinking 16 times 2,000. That's $32,000. I'm fucking rich. Like, I mean, I was just like so removed from it. You know, like I just didn't ever even, you know, and I don't know, man. Like, I think that like as I grew up and the house got bigger because dad was increasingly successful, you know, like I was really self-conscious about my privileged upbringing, you know, like the big house. I was embarrassed to have kids from school like come over and see that I lived in this big house, you know, like I was kind of ashamed of my parents' wealth, and you know, and as a result I was just never, I never really found myself you know, motivated by wealth, like, you know, and I just needed very little to get by. And so he had $32,000, like, holy shit, man, I'm rich. Like,
and you didn't negotiate. You didn't negotiate. That
I didn't negotiate at all. No, not whatsoever. And I remember we started filming. I got paid half towards the beginning. And $32,000 after taxes came to like $20,000. And I got half of that. So I received a check for $10,000. And when I found out that I was going to receive a check for $10,000, I called up the director, Jeff Tremaine, and I said, yo, dude, I'm about to get a check for $10,000, and that shit isn't even going to be cleared. I'm going to put it in the bank, and before it even clears into the account, I am going to be fucking in my car driving out to California. I was in Florida at the time. And I'm going to drive fucking, you know, I'm fucking driving out to LA. I'm moving out to LA to fucking ride this wave. And Jeff Tremaine said that he said, you're not going anywhere until you send me a list of ideas to film in every state between Florida and California. And if the list is on point, then I'll fly out a production team to follow you across country and get all this footage on the road. So that's what we did, and it put me way ahead of the game for shooting for those, you know, for that third season, I suppose. And yeah, that was the deal, man. I moved out there and I got out to California and everyone was like, dude, you know, you better strike while the iron's hot, man. You know, you're fucking, the show's going to be canceled. This moment's going to pass. And I found that frustrating because I was just trying to like be in the moment. And that's like kind of, everybody was a little bit right. You know, I mean, they are right. Like up to that point, I viewed all of my video footage, like in sort of like a dark, like religious kind of a way that like, fuck, we're all going to be dead, but I want to live forever. And when I videotape something, that fucking video can play after I'm dead. So I won't be dead at all. Like I'm going to fucking live forever. And I had this like, this super like, just like sacred view of like the immortality of video footage. You know, footage is forever. Like, oh, you know,
right.
Like, there's this huge importance to what I was doing. But then when I got out to California and everyone's like, oh, it's going to be, you know, just strike while they're on top. Like it really dawned on me that footage is not fucking forever. You know, when you're actually in the game, the footage has an expiry date, you know, like the footage comes out and then it just spoils, you know, like once right. It's out, once it's rotten. And then like, now what are you, that's gone. Like now what are you going to do? You know? And then and life turns into this this really fucking frantic, desperate, pathetic, like, you know, chasing the spotlight around to try to always have like, what's next? You know, like, what do you got next? It's just this scary, daunting question. Like, fuck, you have to have something next or you're, you know, you're only as good as what you're doing right fucking now.
And I hate that. And, I've always hated that when people are like, well, so what are you up to? I'm right here with you right now. That's what I'm up to.
Right.
What is this? Oh, I got this. And then you feel worse when you start talking to people and go, oh, well, I'm doing this and I'm writing this and I'm doing, shut the fuck up. You know, I don't need to sit here and talk about it. It just, you feel stupid because you almost feel like you're defending not doing anything.
Right.
For
sure. And I found it scary. I found it frustrating. And the idea of being in the limelight, you know, being in the spotlight is it's inherently fucking dark and depressing because, you know, it's a temporary situation, you know, and to try to keep that going, it's like it's a lot of pressure and it's a lot. But whether I liked it or not, whether it was fucked up, there's nothing healthy about a life as an, you know, an entertainer. You know, show business, there's nothing fucking healthy about fame or celebrity. But at the same time, nobody's trading it in. And, you know, from when I got out to California, I just felt like, oh, fuck you. Fuck everybody. Like, you tell me to strike when the iron's hot. Fuck you. Like, I'll make the fucking iron hot, dude. And fucking, you can strike, you fucking assholes. You know, like, I'll fucking, you know, and it motivated me. And from the very beginning, and even when I was, like, wildly out of control on drugs, like, I just hit the hustle button, you know? Like, I know that when Jackass first got ordered, like I said, I had all this video footage, all this shit that I sent into Real TV and stuff. And when Jeff Tremaine first told me that the pilot got ordered to series, he said, the first thing you do is pack up all the video footage you got. I know you got a lot and send it to us so we can license it and just put some of it straight onto the show. And I was like, fucking right on. And when I sent it in, he told me, I called back and I'm like, dude, so what are you guys going to use? And he was like, sadly, not one clip you sent us is allowed on TV. Like, I mean, to be fair, in some cases, it was just shitty fucking dubbed back and forth. The quality was low. In some cases, it was just filmed bad. But for the most part, my thing was like, my specialty was jumping off roofs, you know. And my motto was that whatever you're doing, it's cooler if you're on fire. You know? And two of the rules that we had, like they kind of, you know, we had rules that we had to kind of follow. And that was that if we were going to jump off of something off of Jackass, it couldn't be over a certain height because they were really worried about little kids copying it. And MTV had like all kinds of problems with fire. Where like they had one lawsuit where a kid in a trailer park, like burned down the trailer, killed his sister. And they were like, why did you do that? And he says, Beavis, fire, you know, like, and MTV was found liable. So, and then they had another fire and then another lawsuit. So MTV just didn't fuck with fire, you know?
And, I, like, and here you are, fire guy.
Yeah, I'm the fire guy. I'm 100% the fire guy, man. And like, if I'm not jumping off something that's way too high for MTV, I'm probably doing that. I'm probably on fire while I'm doing that. And if it's not either of those things, then it's something like even more fucked up, you know, because like I had a real knack for dark shit. And the point being, I tell that because out of the gate, the first impression I had of the show, and I think this was before it even was called Jackass when they had ordered it. I think it was like working titles, you know. I thought, fuck, man, like this is kind of like weird. Like it's going to be cool if we get a TV show, but how watered down is it going to be? You know, like what kind of a fucking pussy ass show is this going to be? I thought, but oh well, you know, they're telling me that I can make two hot for TV videos, because in that time, during that whole era, you know, late night TV was littered with Girls Gone Wild, you know, like kind of these like not allowed on TV videos, and if you call right now, right, we'll throw in a bonus video.
Right.
So I knew that I was going to be making two hot for TV DVDs, and I got to work with that like really pretty quickly. And, you know, it was like I teamed up with some people who didn't think it was important to pay me.
Seems like you've done that a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, let me ask you. Yeah. Do you feel like now after, you know, you got control of the drinking, you've been sober, what, 10 years?
12 years.
And you're engaged. You still engaged, or?
I am. I'm still engaged.
All right. So you survived somehow. You did all these things. And here you are. We're in our 40s. You're probably in your 40s, right?
46.
All right, you're younger than I am. But now you're sitting in your trailer and you're doing tattoos and you're going on the road and you got this YouTube channel. Are you able, like a few minutes ago, you were talking about you just want to be in the moment. And like they're saying, you got to do this, you got to do this. And it kind of fucks up that moment when you start to feel like things, all the stress builds up and all you have to. Do you feel now sitting here, do you feel like you're enjoying the moment now? Do you feel like you're getting a grasp on who you are?
It's such a gnarly question, you know, and I would compare that question I find it so uncomfortable if somebody says, or I used to find it uncomfortable to be asked, are you happy?
I didn't say that happy.
Seems like such a simple question. Are you happy? And over the years, I feel like that being asked if I'm happy made me terribly uncomfortable. Because my honest answer, my gut instinctual, answer is no, I'm not fucking happy.
Yeah.
You know, and I just know that I'm not fucking happy. I know that I don't enjoy the moment, and I do enjoy some moments, but overall, I have this like this overwhelming sense of impending doom. You know, and maybe it's that same impending doom about, oh, you strike while the iron's hot, you're going to be a hazard. Maybe that's just like fucking scarred onto my brain. But when I think about it, and I finally come to terms with that question, and I've come to terms with my honest answer being, no, I'm not happy. And I've come to terms with that because I finally decided, you know, what the fuck does being happy get you? You know, what does being happy, like, oh, I'm happy, I'm content, okay, so I'm just going to chill, you know, like, no, like, I think that I have a sense of impending doom, some feeling that everything is not fucking okay, that it's not going to be fucking okay, and that I better frantically hustle to try to work to make things okay. And as such, I'm not comfortable, I'm not happy, but that's where my hustle comes from, you know, and I, like, rather than be lazy and content, I would rather be super uncomfortable and fucking hustling like a maniac to get shit done, you know?
Yeah.
So I mean, like, it's a point of pride for me that I'm not happy, that I'm not content, that I can't enjoy the moment because it's just fucking, I've got to make shit happen. And so then I feel like there's another component to the question is that you know, beyond, am I enjoying the moment? Am I able to be happy? But like, have I gotten, you know, having done like bad, like pretty bad business over the years, I was never motivated by money. I'm just an attention whore. You know, I didn't do very well business-wise. Every attempt at investing money has just completely gone sideways on me. And, you know, but at this point where I'm at now, you know, and as a result of being sober, able to focus myself and not waste time making bad decisions, but really just kind of apply myself deliberately in productive ways, like I'm finally kind of getting better at the business side of things, you know. I've put together, like with my attention whoring, I've been able to put together a substantial following on social media. And, you know, I really care. I care so much about the quality of the content that I put out. And I think that has built a level of goodwill with my audience. You know, they know that if I post something that like they can click play and that it's generally, they can count on it being a good video, that kind of thing. And with that following, it doesn't mean that you're doing well, you know, like to have a big social media following, it is like sort of like, you know, having a storefront with lots of traffic coming through, but that doesn't really accomplish much if there's nothing on the shelves that you have for sale, you know, like it's like the social media is an engine and you need that if that engine's not attached to anything, then nothing's really happening.
Inside of You is brought to you by Factor. Factor Meals has changed my life. I am not spending tons of money ordering delivery service all the time anymore. I get delicious meals that are customized to my liking. I can make them in just 2 minutes. I have a menu of over 35 options delivered to my door. Calorie smart, keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, you choose. Discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feeling good all day long. And these meals are delicious. I've had their chicken. I've had their chili. I have had their burgers. This is delicious. You're going to save money and no more stress going to the grocery store, Ryan. You don't want to go to the grocery store all the time when you can have your meals delivered right there for you.
Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring.
Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You simply heat and savor the good stuff.
Tailored to your schedule, customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle.
Head to factormeals.com/inside50 and use code inside50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code inside50 at factormeals.com/inside50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I see a lot of parallels with you and I. It's weird. It's just like, you know, because that's the same feeling. Like, I always felt really bad if somebody asked me that fucking question. And I didn't say, are you happy? I just felt like, are you in a better place? And I think what right. I, you know, people would say, are you happy? And I go, and I felt fucking horrible that I couldn't immediately just say yes, because innately it was no.
Right.
And I was like, but look around you and I'm grateful and all these things. Right. I'm like, what's fucking wrong with you? With therapy and this and that, like what, why can't you be, you know, but then, you know, what makes me happy? And I think maybe you could accept this, is that the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that we've worked on ourselves, the fact that we've come from a certain place and that we're trying to be better and better as whatever, as a person, I feel like you're doing that, to be better as a person, to be better as a human being, to be better as a friend, to be, but whatever it is, those things, and it sounds so corny, but if you look at yourself kind of out of control on drugs and lighting yourself on fire and doing all this shit, and now you're petting a dog and you're, you know, you're doing these videos and you're sober and you're doing, maybe you could at least in retrospect go, well, I'm happier. I'm actually aware of what I am.
And I don't want to create the impression that like I'm miserable and that I hate my life. It's no. not that. It's not that. And I'm profoundly grateful for the progress that I've made. Like intellectually, I can absolutely grasp how pleased I am with the way things are going, you know? It's a philosophy of Buddhism that all suffering comes from craving, and that whether things are good or bad, say, this is like a Buddhist thing that I kind of really latched onto. If we're in pain, we crave for that pain to end. It's just common sense, you know? But if we're having some pleasurable sensation, we every bit as much crave for that pleasurable sensation to intensify, to last longer, you know? Like, no matter what fucking situation we're in as human beings, we crave for, you know, more good. And like, I don't know. And so that's why people who have millions and millions of dollars, they crave more, you know? Like, there's just no fucking situation you can put the human being in, you know, where it's enough and you don't crave something more. And that's why, like, the philosophy of Buddhism is that your happiness, you just have to be happy on with what is, not with how you want it to be, you know? Right, like, that's right. Like being in the present, like accepting this how shit is. And I don't even try that.
I was telling my buddy yesterday to my friend Tom, I was like, I just am always anxious. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah. And I go, but I'm anxious about everything. He's like, what? I go, like, everything. Like, I got to go down and get the mail. I'm anxious. I got to go take a shit now. I wanted to do something, but I have to shit. I'm anxious.
Yeah, 100%. Do you take any medication?
Yeah, I'm trying something right now that kind of helps with anxiety that, in the beginning stages. So I haven't really felt any effect. Are you on something?
Yeah, dude, I got a psychiatrist and I take Zoloft and I absolutely, it's not anything that gives you a buzz. Like it's never in any circumstances been considered a substance of abuse. I just find that if I'm not taking Zoloft, like a relatively minor disturbance, something that bothers me, like, you know, yeah, something that bothers me a little bit can very easily send me to suicidal ideation. I've never been like proactive on any level, you know, about killing myself. But what I have done, and particularly when not taking Zoloft, is just squander a lot of valuable time with like some crazy like fantasies about how I could make it so nobody would ever discover the body and that it would be this mystery of what happened to him, like all this crazy dark fucking just perverse shitty fucking time wasted. And I don't deal with that for the most part when I'm on taking my Zoloft.
Do you deal with pain from all the stunts and all the bullshit you've done? And what do you do for pain?
Since I got sober 12 years ago, I've not even filled out a prescription for painkillers. My rule is that when I'm in the hospital, if they got to knock me out for a procedure, then fucking general anesthesia, that's just part of the deal. You know, and that's them doing it to me.
Right.
If while I'm in the hospital, they're going to put something into my IV, like that's fine. But my rule is that once I'm out of the hospital,
nothing.
Like I don't fucking fill out a prescription because that's where it gets slippery. Right. In possession of it and I'll take it as prescribed. Like that's just a slippery slope.
Stunts? Do you still do that shit?
For sure.
Like yeah, you're comfortable with that. You're like, you're still, are you pretty fearless? Would you say?
God, no, I'm gripped by fear. I'm gripped by fear. I feel pain. And those are, I think, two very crucial ingredients to the success of the projects that I've been a part of, because if I was fearless, there'd be no trepidation. There'd be, it'd just be like, oh, you know.
Right, right, right.
And that's the fear is kind of what makes it engaging, you know? And yeah. The pain is to not feel pain, where there'd be no reaction.
All right. Hey, listen. Hey, this is called Shit Talking with Steve-O. These are from my patrons. They're just asking you rapid questions. Here it is. Brett G., can you share a paranormal experience that's scared the crap out of you?
Very little about my paranormal experiences were scary. Some of them were, but I had like insane hallucinations, hearing voices, like all kinds of people walking around who weren't physically there while I was on drugs. And rather than regale it, I would point you to Steve-O Ghost Stories. Like that's what we called it. I told it on the H3 podcast, and I don't think I can do a better job of recounting it. So,
all right, search, yep.
On YouTube, search Steve-O Ghost Stories.
Christopher M., if time travel was possible, would you want to go into the future, or would you like to visit the past?
Well, anybody would want to go to the past, I think, to improve their situation now. Right, look back to the future too.
Right? Hey, Steve-O, don't jump off that cliff, asshole. If you can go back, though, like, honestly, is there anything you would change? That one thing you always remember, like, fuck, are there plenty of things that you would change?
I would certainly like to have gotten sober at least 2 years sooner. If I could,
why 2 years?
Because I wouldn't want to. I'd want to be very careful with the space-time continuum up until that point, I just really mismanaged opportunities, and I got like the last 2 years of my drinking and using were really fucking destructive, humiliating, and counterproductive. I suppose I needed all of that humiliation and destruction in order to like be properly motivated, so I probably wouldn't want to mess with that either.
Dave P., is there a specific stunt that you performed for Jackass that you look back and regret?
For Jackass, it's all the regrets are all about not digging deeper. You know, there were just certain things that I didn't go for, and so the footage didn't make it anywhere. You know, like there's nothing I regret doing. It's we regret what we haven't done. It's better to regret what you have done than what you haven't done, and that's true in my case.
I like it. Maddie asks, what stunt did you end up not doing but wish you would have?
There's so many of them.
All right.
The one that comes to mind is trying to unicycle over a balance beam over hot coals in India. I just couldn't fucking commit to it, man. And it was such a magnificent set. And I just fucking, they set it up for nothing.
Were they pissed?
No. Yeah, I mean, it's not like that. Like, I was pissed. Like, nobody could possibly have been more disappointed in me than I was. And then on the subsequent movie, we did the Fire Gauntlet as a redemption, and it just wasn't nearly as cool.
Were you ever fucked up on a lot of stunts?
On my own time for my Too Hot for TV DVD series, that was all those are fucking streaming at steveo.com too. If you go to the bottom, Steve-O TV, But it was a much darker operation when, I was shooting on my own time. Like, then it was like, you know, like, if we were too fucked up filming for Jackass, then it would be a little bit like the end of Boogie Nights, where he's like, I'm at cock card, I'm ready to fuck, and he's all tweaked out on meth. And Burt Reynolds says, like, look, man, I can't have you on camera like this. You're a fucking mess, you know? Like,
right.
It's a little bit, like, Jackass is a little bit more like that. That makes our director Jeff Tremaine a bit like that Burt Reynolds, you know, like,
right.
it's not the spirit of Jack. In Jackass, you see us like over the years, like hungover, even acknowledging being hungover. There was not that like active I'm wasted on camera, because that was never the spirit of it. was very much the spirit of what I did on my own time, though.
Right. Leanne P., what's your biggest fear?
I mean, it's like, I think, you know, fear, I've heard fear defined as, you know, being either not getting what you want or losing what you have is the basis of all fear, I think. And, you know, like not getting what you want. I want to be loved. I want to be important, you know, like, and the idea of not getting that, you know, or like losing everything. Like, of course, like I've worked so hard to save what I have, like I'm afraid of losing it. So I think fear is pretty basic in that sense.
Alyssa C., final question. What is the one thing you couldn't imagine living without besides Wendy?
Oh my God. If fucking anything happened to Wendy, I would. And she comes from the streets, so I give her like so much freedom. I just let her roam around. I'm gonna do that right now. And it's just panic inducing when I'm walking around looking for her and I can't find her. But yeah, at the same time, I have to give her freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but it's something I can't live without. I would kind of just say, I'd say my team, you know. I've got you know, my guy Scott Randolph is like my right hand in everything that I do with you know, production and merchandising. And then I've got my other guy, Paul Brisky, who's my editor. And I'd be fucked without both those guys. Those guys are my secret weapons.
That's awesome.
And then I have another secret weapon who's a guy named Guy Hickey, who lives in Australia. And I mean, this kid, Guy Hickey, is just badass. Like, I met him as a fan, like, probably 15 years ago, maybe. I don't know. And then this kid can just whatever it is, like, if it's finding something that's really hard to find, like, he'll find it, you know?
Right.
There's just a lot. So yeah, I can't live without the people who I work with.
You know, the last thing I want to say is I just keep seeing you not getting into Barnum and Bailey Circus School. And I just, yeah. I want to know how devastated at that time in your life you were.
I did get into the circus school. Specifically, it was called Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Clown College.
Right.
And 33 clowns got in, got accepted. All 33 clowns graduated, but the idea was only 10 of them. 10 of the clowns got contracts with the Ringling Circus, and I was not one of those 10.
Do you think you were worthy? You should have been selected.
I mean, I like stuck out. Like, as soon as I showed up, it was like, well, this guy. I mean, the reason I went to clown college was because I wanted to become a crazy famous stuntman, and I just wasn't getting anywhere on my own. You know, it was my home video camera, like, just nobody cared. And I just found, when I found out about Clown College, I thought, oh, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, like, it's this reputable, you know, it's just like a known name. And then if I could graduate from Clown College, then I would be a circus professional. People would take me more seriously as a stuntman. So it was more of just a means to an end.
Right.
And it was evident when I got to Clown College that I had no aspirations of being a clown. You know, I was just using this as a way to further my goal of becoming a stuntman. So out of the gate, there was that. And then there was like, I was fucking drunk every night, you know, like in the first week they had to take me to the hospital and get my head stapled together for shit that I was doing. Like, that had nothing to do with fucking clowning. Like, so yeah, I kind of disqualified myself pretty aggressively right away.
It just sounds like a movie, a guy who goes to clown school and then doesn't get selected as the clown to go to the circus. It just sounds like a movie.
I mean, perhaps, you know, I wrote a movie that my buddy's actually trying to get made, which is crazy. And it's definitely about a clown.
And how bad does it hurt to get when you stapled your balls What'd you do? You stapled?
I mean, there's less nerve endings in your ball sack. You know, like I would never put a staple through my actual ball.
But through the skin, it's not as bad.
Through like what I've done, you know, repeatedly for years, like stapling my ball sack to my leg. And I think that in some cases, there's been the staple holes in my ball sack like became infected. Like there was a couple times where I did that and did another trick where I flipped my balls back and forth and catch them in a mangina. And doing that like ruptured something one time, like where it was filled with blood, my whole ball sack. It looked like a plum. And but you know, for the most part, it's been pretty minor.
Did your girlfriend or your fiance did she want to look down there and like kind of examine? Do you have scars on your balls and things?
No. And if she was going to be examining it, she wouldn't be looking for scars. That's for sure. but yeah, no, my girl's pretty fucking down with like all the shit she's okay with is pretty shocking.
Well, dude, look, man, this has been awesome because I don't know you. I think I might have seen you somewhere years ago, but I feel like it's just so easy to talk to you. You're so open. I just love that about you. And Steve-O, people can go on the YouTube channel. You got over 5 million followers. It's so fun to just go to a video. You find yourself there for like an hour. So they just need to go to Steve-O.com.
Steve-O.com is the hub where all of my stuff lives. You know, I gotta plug my book, which
please,
it's special because on Amazon it's got an average rating of 5 stars. It's a reliably good book. It's fucking juicier than shit, and every single copy that I sell at steveo.com is personally autographed. You know, I'm actually down here at our warehouse in Carlsbad just signing books right now.
Awesome.
And it's just a fucking juicy ass book. It's meaningful for me to get it out there because my story, to the extent that it's inspiring and uplifting and just crazier than shit, it means a lot for me to get it out there.
What's it called?
It's called A Professional Idiot, A Memoir.
Professional Idiot, A Memoir. Get his book. Yeah. I mean, your story's incredible and it's touching too. You could just tell that there's a lot of heart and, you know, you've had a lot of shit go on in your life, a lot of success and all that, but we're all striving to be the best we can and achieve some sort of like being okay with ourselves. Just being like, all right, sure. I'm a fuck up. This is who I am, but I'm doing my best. Fuck yeah. It. You know what I mean?
For sure, man.
So, man, it was a joy talking to you, man. Anytime you want to come on, man, you're a pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate it, dude. I was looking forward to this. It was well worth my time, and thank you to you as well as everybody else who listens. I also love to do this when I'm on a podcast that I think was a good experience. It's speaking directly to the people who are still listening, because as podcasters, we've got a drop-off rate, you know, and those who stick around to the very end of the podcast, who represent that fucking full retention rate, like they really are the stars, you know, they're what we do it all.
Yeah.
So speaking to those people who are still listening this deep into the podcast, an extra thank you from me. And if you really did enjoy it or anything, like shoot me a tweet, because when I say, hey, I listened all the way to, if I see tweets, I listened all the way to the end on this podcast, fucking thank you. Like those tweets mean like more than anything. So
me too.
Shoot me a tweet if you're still listening and thanks to everybody involved.
You're a good dude, man. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Hey, likewise, man. Thank you.
I like him. There's something just kind of, I don't give a F about him, but I do. Mm-hmm. Not me, but like himself. Like he doesn't like, he almost has that I don't care, but I do care attitude, doesn't he?
Yeah.
There's something about that that's kind of sweet. It's like, I'm just going to do my own thing and I just don't care, but I do care how it affects people. And I am a fuck up, but you know, good for him. I enjoyed talking to him. I think he was like, who the fuck is this guy? And then we started talking. But I was kind of like, I know him from Jackass and all that stuff, but I really liked him. I thought he was a solid guy. Thank you to everyone out there listening. Thank you. Check out the Sunspin new music video where you can find it on Instagram. on Sunspin Band, or I'm sure we'll post on Twitter and it's YouTube. And you can also go to sunspin.com and get all the merch, the sweet CDs and t-shirts and hats and lunchboxes. Tell us what you think. You can go to hello@inside. Look at this. It's right here. Mm-hmm. See, you can go to hello@insideofyoupodcast.com, right? Mm-hmm. But you can leave messages there. I check them here and there. You can go to the Inside of You online store and get a bunch of Smallville shit and lunch boxes and shirts and stuff. That's that. Please write a review if you love the show. To all my patrons out there, here's looking at you. I appreciate all your love and your devotion to the podcast. I got these new shirts for the top tier patrons, and mm-hmm. it's like a 1 year sort of like bomb squad, BAUM, Rosenbaum squad.
Got it.
Right.
Got it.
Here's a patron shout out: Nancy D, Mary B, Leah S, Trisha F, Sarah V. They're all right here. Look at this. Little Lisa, Yukiko, Jill E, Brian H, Lauren G, Nico P, Robin S, Jerry W, Robert I, Jason W, Stephen J, Kristen.
Okay.
You're on top of it. Amelia.
Oh.
Good Lord. Allison L, Jess J, Lucas M, Raj
C,
Joshua
D,
Emily
F,
S,
shit,
CJ
P,
Samantha
N,
M, good close, Jennifer N, Jackie That's P, Stacy L, Carly H, Jen S, Jamal F, Janelle B, Carrie B, Tabitha 272, not to be confused with
Tabitha 273,
Ashley Ryan, Kimberly E, Mike E, Marissa N, L, Don Supremo, that's Dan, Jack S, good old Slater, Ramira, Beth B, Santiago M, Sarah F, Chad W, Leanne P, Ray A, Maya P, Maisha, Maddie S, Kendrick F, Ashley F, Shannon D, Matt W, Belinda N, Kevin V, James R, Chris H, Osborne, Amy C, we got Dave H, Samantha S, Spider-Man,
Chase,
Sheila
G,
Ray H, Alyssa C, Tabitha T, Misha N. Well, let's go a new one. So if I ask you, you know, Tom
C,
N, Tom N, Henry S, Tom N, Henry S. Remember those the next time. Mm-hmm. Liliana A. Michelle K. What up, Michelle? Hannah B. Michael S. I could do Tracy Morgan. Talia. Luke H. John S. I don't really do him. Andrew. For a second, I did.
Did you see his thing on the Golden Globes?
No. Was it bad?
No. He announced, I think it was Best Animated, and the winner was Soul, but he read the card as Soul.
Yo, Soul. People dying?
It's great.
You know, if I did that, I would get just hounded. Like, this guy's an idiot. You're an idiot. But him, everybody thinks it's funny.
It was on brand.
It's on brand. Sow.
He didn't mean to do it.
He didn't mean to do it? No. Yeah, of course he didn't mean to do it. Talia M, Mike S, Luke H, John S, Andrew T, Claire M, Liz J, Laura L, Chad B, Rachel E, or Rochelle. I think it's Rochelle. But it's Rachel because there's no E at the end of it. So it's Rachel. I'm right. Nathan E, Brandel D, Taylor K, Neil A, Marion E, Meg K, Janelle P, Dan P, Jennifer J, Wayne M, Ojeda. When I say Ojeda, you say Ojeda. Lorraine G. Guys, thank you so much for being here with us today with Ryan and myself. I really appreciate you, and you take the time to listen to the podcast every week. So spread the word. Email your friends, get them to listen, write a review, do all that shit. Thank you for allowing me to be inside each and every one of you. From Ryan and myself here in the Hollywood Hills.
Lifestyles of the rich and famous. It's
Lifestyles of the rich and
Michael
famous.
Michael Rosenbaum's hat.
It's Lifestyles of the less rich and the not as famous. That's what it is. And there'll be people who write and go, Michael, don't do that to yourself. You're famous. You're rich. I'm like, well, rich, believe me. I know rich. I know folks that are rich. Rich is when you don't have to worry about anything. Yeah. Wealthy is like old money. Like, yes, would you like to drive the Rolls this evening, ma'am? Mom.
Yeah.
All right. Wave at the camera, Ryan.
Okay, bye.
All right, we love you. Blame it on the rain.
Oh, great.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.